So I thought I would start out tonight by kind of putting this dependent origination in perspective. There's a way that the Dhamma works. It's so magical. It's so mysterious. So the way I want to show you that is, back in 2017 is when Tim and I, Rodney ended his teaching period in 2016, at the end of December. And 2017 is when Tim and I started teaching, and we had thought, oh, we need to come up with a theme for the year so that people would know what we were going to talk about. When it was Rodney teaching, he could teach however he wanted to, but when you have two people teaching, one person can go down that track and one person can go down this track. So we thought, oh, we'll come up with a theme and then we'll teach from that. So we picked the paramis. And so we spent a year in 2017 cultivating an open heart on looking into the paramis. And then in 2018, we spent that year looking at the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. And then last year we looked at the hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. And this year we're going to look into dependent origination. So when you first think about that, you might just think, oh, this is all lists, just a list of stuff. You know, just this list and that list. And that's all Dhamma is really, is about a list of this, a list of that. But that's not actually what happened. And when I was beginning to think about, you know, preparing for this talk, it really makes sense. I think somebody asked me, can you explain how all of this ties together when we start out this talk in ignorance? And the way it all ties together is we need to open our hearts. I mean, that's what the paramis do. We had to open our hearts as a sangha in order to begin to think about suffering. You can't really think about suffering with a closed heart. You can try it. But just imagine if you're feeling really miserable and somebody coming up and saying, you know, there's suffering everywhere. How open are you going to be to that concept? It's almost as if inherent in your state of being, you don't want to hear what they have to say. So we spent this year opening the heart, that year back in 2017, talking about all these concepts of heart-generated, far-reaching understandings around generosity and truthfulness and patience and energy and all of that. And then the very next year, we decided to talk about the Four Noble Truths. But when you think about it, the Four Noble Truths, we were thinking, oh, this is foundational. But what we were really doing was talking about the nature of suffering, the nature of it. These four ennobling truths help us see that our path to freedom doesn't come from getting over suffering. It comes actually through suffering. And when you start talking about suffering, inevitably you're going to talk about reactivity. It's just inherent in it. The pushing against it and the not wanting and the wanting and all of that. Pushing, pushing, pushing. So of course, the hindrances and the time that we spent in the hindrances and the seven factors of awakening, that is actually the nature of suffering. It's either we are reacting to something we like or don't like, or there's a space where there's non-reactivity, which is the seven factors. So there's this reactivity, which is the five hindrances, and this non-reactivity, which is the seven factors. That's the nature of suffering in and of itself. And the more we're able to see, I'm trapped in some kind of a hindrance here, or C, that there's no hindrance here, the more we begin to understand the nature of suffering and how it shows up in our everyday life. So what do you think this dependent origination, when we just decided to do this, I think Tim and I were just thinking, oh, it's 12 links, 12 months, that's pretty good. But actually, we are going to talk about the cause of suffering, which is the second noble truth. That's exactly what this month is, this year is going to be about. It is the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering is clinging and the dependent origination, or sometimes you'll hear teachers call it dependent co-arising, this understanding of the dependency of these 12 links and how they create suffering, how it is that suffering arises. It's not by chance that in 2020 we would be now stepping into dependent co-arising, dependent origination. This is where we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be looking into the causation of suffering. That's one thing about where we are on this path. The second part, though, is that given the nature of dependent co-arising, this dependent origination, given the nature of it, we could fall into this trap of thinking we're going to learn something. I'm going to study that. I'm going to learn it. There's no learning here. You can try to learn it, but it doesn't work like that. It reminds me of this time on a retreat when I had overwhelming doubt. Oh, I think I told you guys. It was bad. It's the worst of the worst. Worst time. I've never had doubt like this. It's overwhelming. I didn't trust anything. I didn't believe anything. I just was so convinced that I had somehow or another been faking it my whole life on the path. And I have a little pocketbook of, I think it's called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. It's just the little 101 Zen stories and Zen koans. And I will look at that every once in a while on retreats when the mind is really, really stuck, because a lot of those koans don't make any sense to me at all. And if your mind's in a place where it doesn't make any sense, throw it in a koan, best thing ever. But I remember this one particular koan. Hopefully I can say it right. But a monk was wandering around in the dark with a lighted lantern looking for fire. And the commentator said, if he knew what fire was, he could have eaten his rice sooner. That's the problem with trying to understand or learn dependent origination, trying to learn this process, these links. Let me learn them. Once I get them, then I'll have it. But you'll be stumbling around in the dark with a lantern that's lit because you don't know you already have the fire you need to cook. You don't know that, because you're too busy focused out there trying to learn something. So keep this in mind when you think about this whole year and how am I going to understand all this stuff. The Buddha taught dependent origination to everybody, anybody. It didn't really matter. He didn't consider, do you have an education? He didn't check to see whether people were at a certain level or economic status or anything like that. If you came up to him, whoever you were, he was going to teach you dependent origination. That's how simple it actually is. And the only way to really sort of take on this subject without getting caught in the mind's need to know and learn and I got to do this whole education thing around it is you have to practice with it. There is no other way to begin to understand how these links show up. I spent all last week at this teacher training. So Andrea Fella, she happened to give this Dhamma talk on dependent co-arising our good fortune. And she said that the links are so entwined that a better way to think about it is that when you grab onto something, you got all 12 links at the same time. You got to get this. Let me see if I can show you. So, all 12 links at the same time. So how are you going to divide that up, right? All of them, all 12 links, same time. They all arise at the exact same time. So if you're going to try to parse it out and understand and learn it, you will lose the context of what it is that it's saying. Instead, I think there's a better way to think about these links that I want to talk about them tonight, starting with ignorance. There's a way in which you could think every single month, every link we're going to talk about is your practice to the whole thing. So if you practice with ignorance this month, you will see dependent origination regardless of whether or not you see the rest of the links. So let's say you miss it this month. Okay, I missed that whole ignorance thing. You know, we're moving on to mental formations next month. You practice with that, you get dependent origination. You miss that. You go on the next month. We get the consciousness. You practice with that, you get it. Meaning that this learning isn't about learning all the 12 links in that way. This is about learning to turn into the situation and see how everything is co-arising together. There's no separation between our experience in life and our thinking of ourselves in life. The two are intertwined together. It's what we call identification. It is the selfie nature of I, me, and mine. And inherent in that thought of I, me, and mine, I see something, I hear something, I experience something, I, this is mine, that is mine. Inherent in that thought, that moment when it feels like me, that's dependent origination. And the only way to really see it is to begin to parse it out and practice with each one of these links one at a time and see what it feels like. So that's what I'm going to try to talk about. How can we feel into the ignorance here? One way you can feel, I think there are three ways you can feel into ignorance. One of them, probably the one that most people connect to how we practice, how we are as human beings, is blindness. There's a level of blindness that we live in. A poem by one of the nuns. She She's her name is I think it's Dhira, Dhira, self-reliant. She says, "Look closely, my heart. See how all things arise and pass away. Even that which is turning the shapes on this page into the sounds and thoughts you are right now silently speaking to yourself. See how all things rise and pass away, even that which is turning the shapes on this page into the sounds and thoughts you are right now silently speaking to yourself. When you no longer need to read the signs you find your way, when you no longer need to read the signs you find your way, you'll know for yourself that books and maps can only get you so far. There is a direct path." That is exactly what practicing with ignorance is about. There's a blindness into this. There's a blindness into this understanding of Dhamma. There's a blindness in which we live our lives in. We are swimming in it. We live in it. It's blind. It's obscured, opaque. We cannot see it. So until we're willing to begin to maneuver through life without reading the signs along the way, feeling our way into it, we will always be trapped in that blindness because we can't see. And the best way to sort of grasp it is that inevitably, when we walk in the house or we walk anywhere in a room, we turn the lights on so we can see. So I can see the chairs and I can see the rug. I can see where the tables are. I can see. I won't be bumping into things. I won't get hurt because I can see. But never do we let ourselves notice that we could keep the lights off and we could still see. Might take a moment for the eyes to adjust to the lighting, but then the eyes will adjust and we can see. We can maneuver in. Takes a little bit more carefulness, but we can maneuver. So you have to begin to practice this month with turning the lights out around you so you can learn to trust that you can see into this blindness without needing to have the lights on. I think this blindness is what, it's because we can't see the true nature of the three characteristics. We can't see that things are always changing. Things are always changing. They do not stay the same. But yet we walk around expecting that when things are bad, they're always going to be bad. That's why we don't want them to be bad. If something's good, it's always going to be good. And we're always caught off guard as if some change comes along and we didn't expect it. So somehow in this practice, is there a way that we can see beyond the blindness? Let me tell you some things about blindness. I was in an economics class one time. This is the first time I really kind of got a hit, more like a smack, around blindness. I was in an economics class. There was about 75 people in this class. It's a master's level class, rows. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was in a master's level business degree, and this was a organizational development class. It's probably the only class I ever understood out of the whole master's program. That economics was like a foreign language. I knew the teacher was speaking English, but I could not understand what they were saying. So in this organizational class, the class was set up rows, 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 teacher in the front. That's where it's supposed to be. And then one day I walk in, and of course, I'm the only black person in this class. I'm the only black person in my whole year, all the classes that year. So I would just come in and scoot in a table in the back. Just don't mind me. I come into that class one year, and it's all circle tables in there. And of course, as soon as we get in the room, we all stop, and the teacher goes, just take a seat, sit down, I'll explain everything. So I sat down. And when I sat down, after everybody comes in, the teacher begins to explain that we're going to play this game. I'm not doing games in a room full of white people and only me. Somehow this isn't going to work out right. He says, we're going to play this game. You got to go to the middle of the circle. You're going to reach your hand in this bag. So I'll just explain to you all the tables. You know, there's like 6 or 7 round tables. And they all had white bags. And you dip your hand in the bag, pull out some poker chips. And then we're going to play this world market. Go into the center of this room and play this game so you can learn the nature of the world markets. And all of these different tables are countries. I don't want to play. I raised my hand. I said, I can't play this. I already feel nervous about the whole thing. I can't do this. And my teacher said, no, Tori, you have to play. And I said, I just may take a hit for the day and just leave because I can't play this. I feel already nervous. It's not going to be fair to me. And the teacher just looks at me and he goes, Tuari, if you leave this class, you fail this class. So you either play this game or you fail. Oh, okay, I'm like, fine, whatever, I'm going to play this stupid game. So I reach my hand into the bag on the first round and I pull out 5 gold chips. That's the top dog. Gold chips, top. And 5 of them, you can't get better than that. I am too happy. And my team is happy. So they have to go in and negotiate, but I've helped them because I got so many chips. We did this 3 times. Second round, reach my hand in the bag, 5 gold chips. I am floating. We are laughing and playing. We are having the time of our lives. And I'm thinking to myself, man, I had such a judgment about this game. It's not bad at all. Third round, you know, 5 gold chips. So I made it so that my team won. We won. After we get our 3 rounds, we get to pick the rules. And of course, we pick the rules so that we stay in top. Play the game again. All right, we won, our team. So great. I had such a great time. So I tell the teacher, after the teacher's asking questions about what did you think about the game, and I'm like, this is the greatest game. I can't believe I feel so embarrassed because I had so much fun. He goes, Tuari, yep, you had nothing pretty much but gold chips in your bag. I'm like, what? It's rigged. So people over on this side of the room were kind of bitching and whining, and I could hear it. But I'm having so much fun, I'm not even thinking about it. But their bag had mostly white chips, and they had pretty much the low end. He said he's been doing this exercise for 30 years. It turns out the exact same way every single class, and he knew I was going to have a great time as soon as I sat down. There's no nothing. It was already set in motion when I sat down. That's the way life is. We have so much privilege. We have privilege. We have things that are stacked up against us, things that are stacked up in our favor. We don't notice all that. We think we're just going through life, doing it right, working hard, got my stuff, doing my things. I'm doing everything good. We don't see all that privilege that's got some people up here and some people down there. You might hear a little bit of the grumbling back there, but we don't really see it. We don't challenge anything about where we are in life. We think it's all me doing my life, making my life the way it is. We thought in our little table that somehow or another we were just good. You know, when we put our hands in the bag, we diggled it around a little bit and figured out a way to pull out 5 gold chips. It doesn't dawn on us that we're playing in a unbalanced, not equal world. It doesn't dawn on us. So in the practice, we got to begin to open our eyes about that. And we can't open our eyes by simply saying, oh, I got privilege. That's not going to help us open our eyes. Even if he had told me, yeah, your table's good, I still would have had a great time. The Dhamma is more about seeing the truth that this is not you making your way through life. There's no you making your way through life, making your life the way it is. And as we go through these links, you're going to begin to see that there's a conditionality that's connected to things. And that conditionality presets in motion. Certain things come in our way, not come in our way. There were conditions preset in that room when I walked in there. When we were born, there are conditions preset. It's learning to begin to live. What does it mean if I'm living in privilege? So one thing, you can't see the harm. I could not see the harm that was happening to all those people that didn't have a bag full of gold chips. I didn't even pay attention to them. We don't see it. We don't see harm. We don't see the pushing and pulling we're doing in life to make sure we stay on top. We don't see that. But we're doing a little pushing and pulling. This is about learning to practice so that you can see the harm that's actually arising out of conditions. So you can see it. And even more so you cannot continue it. So in some respects, when you go to retreats and you think about, oh, how am I going to see this harm? How am I going to see it? When you go on retreats, you don't see the harm by working really, really hard to see it. That's not how you see wisdom on retreats. Because the mess of retreat is always in your face anyway. The way you actually see harm is you relax more and more and more with it. So blindness doesn't come from this kind of champion our way into it. We're going to go fight all this wrongness. It's because we relax more and more and more and more and more and begin to see, oh, I have education. I have money. I speak English in an English country. I happen to be a citizen. I got papers. I mean, there's just all this privilege that's just stacked up. And then you can begin to see what happens to those who don't have it. And then you can see harm. You might even begin to see ways in which you can take on some of that harm. Imagine what it had to take for people who were living in the privileged world of Germany to have to be willing to risk that privilege in order to help Jews. Right? But if it hadn't been for those people who were willing to risk, I don't know what would be the world. So in some respects, we are trying to challenge the safety net that we live in. We're trying to upset that a little bit. We are not trying to get enlightened on the freeway, the easy way. We're trying to disrupt the apple cart. That's what we're trying to do, so that we can see some of the blindness that keeps us all tucked in. So when things start going crazy over the course of the year, because it will, I can guarantee that, not because I've got all this wisdom and greatness, but because, you know, it always gets crazy over the course of a year. So when the year starts getting crazy, it's beginning to realize you can't step onto this path with the Dhamma and not have some craziness happen. It's not about you. It's the Dhamma doing you, as Philip would say. So, blindness. There's another way, though, that we get caught in ignorance, another way that we don't see ignorance. And it has to do with not ignorance, I guess what you could say it's described as not understanding the Four Noble Truths. So not understanding the nature of suffering. This is another way in which we begin to get caught in the ignorance of our own self-capacity and not understand that suffering is a part of the world we're living in. That is the ticket that you are buying when you step onto this path. You're not buying a ticket towards the way I think sometimes mindfulness and Dhamma is talked about, like, oh, I'm buying the ticket to the better life. No, you're buying the ticket to the suffering side. Everybody else is going over there to the nice, shiny life. You're going down that way where it's all dark and ugly. That's where you're going. I always remember Rodney saying, you know, when judgment comes and Christ returns and everybody that's going to go up to heaven is going up to heaven. He says, if you look for him, he's going to stay down there. He's staying down on earth where all the misery is. Because anyone that knows the path knows, if you step into difficulty, liberation is close by. If you sidestep that difficulty, liberation is far, 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 far away. So somehow we are making this choice to get intimate with difficulty and suffering. And ignorance is when we misunderstand that. I remember one time I asked Rodney, I think it's probably because I never heard the word ignorance in my name, but I asked Rodney, I really like these Brahmaviharas. We were talking about the Brahmaviharas. I love it. I just want to know, how can you, I know the Brahmaviharas are, they come on their own, but how can you make them come quicker? He said, Tuari, there's wisdom what you said in what you're saying, and there's ignorance. I'll tell you the ignorance first. And I just remember sitting in a room with 200 people thinking, Did he just use the word ignorance and me in the same sentence? But that's sort of what it feels like. Are we really like going into the difficulty? Is that what we're doing? Is that what we bought into? And it is. You are not looking for the easy way out. So every single time when you have a difficulty in the month, you are this close to liberation. Every single time. And if we choose to somehow sidestep it, get out of that difficulty, fix the outer conditions so that everything lines up back right again, it's like, oh, feeling good. I've sidestepped that difficulty. You have yet again sidestepped liberation. The Buddha had a word for kind of what I'm talking about. He called it the asavas. It's the floods, the asavas. I like that word, but it is a flood. And you can tell when it happens because the minute we get triggered, we get this rush of difficulty. The minute something happens, it's almost immediately we need to fix it. There's a rushing in of this is not right. There's a swiftness about it. It takes us away. And in that taking us away, we are caught in trying to do whatever we can to make it back right again, to put it back the way it was. Because our mind's initial thoughts, the ignorance of this coal arising, is that something's wrong. These floods show up primarily when we're unfamiliar, uncertain, unknown. I don't know what's going to happen. The whole thing is uncertain. I'm not sure. There's all this confusion. I don't know this. The minute that comes, we get flooded with trying to get back to the familiar, back to that what's known. Let's get it everything back steady again. Get it all back the way it's supposed to be. But if steadying ourselves and getting it all back the way it's supposed to be were wisdom, we'd have a room full of enlightened beings right now because we're all trying to have it steady the way it's always supposed to be. So there's something maybe in the unknown, that which I am not familiar with, that maybe liberation is in that. Maybe that's why I'm not already liberated, because I keep trying to get my world in the ignorance of my familiarity. So here's another poem. Upasama, it's called Calm. And she writes, how do you cross the flood? You cross calmly, one step at a time, feeling the stones. How do you cross the flood, my heart? You cross calmly, one step at a time, or not at all. So what I think she's pointing to is, you got to see it in the moment. I can describe it to you in a talk, but you got to feel it in the moment when something's gone awry this month. It's not going to be much. It could be between now and the time you get home. There comes this moment when there's this rush of reactivity. It's very quick, right there. In that moment, there's this calmly considering, this is suffering here. What if I not try to fix the outer condition to make it all back the way it was? What if I just let it be? What could I see? In a way, this is more like learning to let the floods wash on through us and trust that we're not trying to set things back up. We're going to get triggered. Things are going to happen. We're not going to like it. It doesn't speak to, am I good or bad, or is this right or wrong? You just want to learn to be with difficulty in a way that you're watching it rather than trying to fix it. And in the course of that watching it, then you can begin to learn. If you just studied ignorance, oh, let me get to know ignorance. Okay, so now ignorance is a blindness to the three characteristics. It is a not understanding the Four Noble Truths. Okay, I can understand the Four Noble Truths being, you know, there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, there is a release of suffering. And you can study all of that, but you will get no closer to being with ignorance when you get triggered. And when you get triggered, in your mind's eye, you will want to fix that and get it all set back up again the way I want it to be. And what the Buddha was pointing to with ignorance is that is the opposite direction of liberation. Instead, when you get triggered, you want to see what conditions have come together in this moment in time that has made this become the way it is. And the last one is this ignorance around misconception. We misperceive things. The poem I picked out is by Dhammadina. She who has given herself to the Dhamma. The names of these nuns is the title of the poem. And then Maddie, he just gave the English definition of what their names mean. So Dhammadina means she who has given herself to the Dhamma. For so long, I thought only of the river's end. For so long, I thought only of the river's end. Then one morning, I set my paddle down to watch the sunrise over the eastern hills. I set my paddles down to watch the sunrise over the eastern hills, only to find myself floating somehow gently upstream. I promise it was not what I expected. I promise it was not what I expected. I think that's the way this misconception is, this misperception is, this ignorance in relation to misperception. It's pointing really to the four distortions of mind. So there's this four, there's the ways where we expect things to be permanent, that which inherently is impermanent. We expect things to be satisfactory, but they are inherently unsatisfactory. We expect things, the world, to be beautiful and lovely, but it is not. It is harsh and ugly. And we expect or take things to be personal when it's not personal at all. So these distortions that the mind does, in order for us to feel as though I got some control in this, those distortions keep us from the Dhamma. So instead, we got to put down our paddles. We got to put down our our expectations about the way things are going to be and how I have to control everything, and just see what happens if we just let the boat gently take us. Just let life just go as it goes, what happens. It's in that way in which we let life and let the Dhamma show itself to us that we can see things that we never expected. The example I want to give you on this happened at the teacher training retreat last week. We went to this anatomy lab to be with and sit with and practice with several dead bodies. And in this lab, the smell of formaldehyde was serious. But we were in there about an hour and a half practicing with these bodies, coming to the understanding that just like them, this is going to happen to all of us. And then we get back to the center. We're doing a little bit of a debrief. And several of us, I could smell this formaldehyde. You know, we smelled it everywhere. We were smelling each other's clothes. I know, I got it on me. I've been in there all that time. It's everywhere, I'm smelling it. And Kel said, Nisha, one of the trainees, is like, that is not formaldehyde. It's not on you. It is a memory. It is a mind memory of formaldehyde. Because even as we smelled each other's clothes, there's no formaldehyde. And yet, how come I smell it everywhere? It is our mind's capacity to take what it knew before and bring it into the present moment as if it's real. And our job in the Dhamma is to see through that delusion. It's almost like you got a question when you wake up in the morning. Are you actually in the morning? Are you in a Memorex? Are you remember four mornings before? Because we do the same things every morning. So we walk around the house and we do all these things, but are we present to what we're doing, or are we living out some morning 15 years ago? This is what it is. This is the mind we're working with. It's not a bad mind. I mean, if you think about it, I don't know what the exact amount is, but there are billions of pieces of data that come into this brain over the course of a day. Who's going to track all that? I can't track it. I can hardly remember stuff I'm supposed to do. So somebody, some part of the mind has to track all this information, categorize it, set it up, organize it, structure it, so we can actually get up and go to work. So I can actually sit here and make some coherent sense. But in that capacity that the mind has to cognize and organize and fix, we can't forget that it's not necessarily telling us the truth. We can't always assume that whatever my mind says, whatever I think, whatever I believe, whatever my view is, whatever my opinion is the truth, no matter how real it seems to us. So in this practice this month, begin to notice how much you are expecting life to be what you think it is. Ultimately, I think You know, I'm going to close here, but I think the thing that we're trying to do with this practice of ignorance is to get up close with the idea that the world may not be what we think it is. It may not be what my mind has created and set it up. But if we're not even willing to challenge the nature of the mind we're operating with, then we're doomed to walk just alongside liberation, never really getting over there, never really getting close to it. We practice and practice and practice and practice, but never really stepping over the line. And all this ignorance is about is to help us realize it's not you, it's not me, it's the nature of being human that ignorance is all around us. We're swimming in this misperception, this blindness, this inability to see and understand suffering. So our job as practitioners is to begin to question. It's to begin to say, there's some blindness here, I know. What am I not seeing? I know what I do see. What do I not see? What am I not seeing? What distortions are operating here that's trying to make the world a certain way? And do I really have to go after and fix the outer world just to avoid some level of discomfort that's passing anyway? Does the whole world have to feel my upsetness when I get triggered? Can I just keep it to myself? Can I just work with it? I'm going to leave you with one story. I'm going to read one last poem here. I used to pick my mother up and take her to this restaurant with her friend after church. And my mother used to irritate me to no end, because as soon as she would sit down, she'd pick up the menu and say, "What do I want to have?" And then she would proceed to read the entire menu, whether it had lettuce or tomatoes, everything on the menu. And I would get so irritated with her. And so finally I said, "Mama, do you have to keep reading the menu every single time we go to a restaurant? Can't you just let us all look at the menu ourselves? Why did you have to read it?" And she told me her friend can't read, so she has to read the menu so her friend knows what she wants. Oh my God! Is that not embarrassing? I was so mad at her! That is the life we are living. We can't tell that some of the things that are happening to us are happening to us because of the need that we have. There's some need that's coming, or some need that someone else has. Who knows why things come to us? Our job isn't always to fix it so we are happy. Sometimes we have to trust that my mother would not be reading in public unless she had to read for someone else. That's the only reason why she would do it. It never dawned on me that she never read the menu except when her friend is with us. It never dawned on me. That's what we're working with. So here's the last poem we're going to read for this talk tonight. Mitta, her name means friend. "Full of trust, you left home and soon learned to walk the path, making yourself a friend to everyone and making everyone a friend. Full of trust, you left home, and soon learned to walk the path, making yourself a friend to everyone and making everyone a friend. When the whole world is your friend, fear will find no place to call home. And when you make the mind your friend, you'll know what trust really means. Listen, I have followed this path of friendship to its end. And I can say with absolute certainty, it will lead you home. Listen, I have followed this path of friendship to its end. And I can say with absolute certainty, it will lead you home. So let's sit a little bit here. Thank you for your kind attention. I think we have time for probably a couple questions if there are any. I know you're all ready to get into this practice with ignorance. Cannot wait. Don't worry. By the time you get to the car, get on the road, you have plenty to work with. Yes.
Something has potentially passed me by, which is of great value to me. Mm-hmm. And so the question I'm having is, do I reach out to try to establish the status quo, which makes me more comfortable, but which also puts me back in touch with this thing, this person, this activity that is of great value? So I'm kind of caught between accepting what might be happening
to intervene on something. All right, so if I reframe this question, so I think you're saying that you had this difficulty and something may have passed you by, but it's like you're questioning whether I should put it back together again, because that would feel more familiar. But it may or may not be the best thing to do. It's like you're lost in whether or not you should put this back or not put this back.
I want to be able to accept if the thing has passed me by.
Yeah.
But I don't want to make it go away just by being passive and not reaching out.
Okay. So you are asking the perfect question for ignorance. And the reason being is because even in the nature of your question, you're trying to solve the solution. In the nature of it, can we all see that? It's almost like if I solve this problem, then I'll know what to do. It'll be smooth. That is the opposite direction of Dhamma. You got to solve the internal resistance one way or the other. Dhamma is not about what is the right solution out here. Dhamma is what is going to ease my, what's going to ease my heart? Like not ease my heart like what will keep me from being upset. What will ease my heart in being upset? In this I don't know what to do moment, there's a way in which we think that if I fix the problem, the heart will ease. And instead, we're trying to ease the heart in the problem without it needing to be fixed. There is no way for the Dhamma to fix emotional difficulty. The only thing we can actually do is fix our resistance to emotional difficulty. So what it means is, whether you bring it back around again or not bring it back around again, from the Dhamma's perspective, is irrelevant. What's really relevant right now, what's really interesting, and what's really, really the place of awakening is, oh my God, I'm in so much suffering, and this is the only way to deal with it. This is the only way to be with suffering, is when suffering has come in front of me. Because if I were to ask you, if you're feeling good, like whatever decision happens, you're feeling good, this was the best thing, oh, thank God, it was the best thing I ever did in my life. And I asked you, why don't you go get some suffering so you can work on liberation? You would not want to get it. This is the point. When suffering has come to us in whatever shape it shows up, it's in that suffering that liberation comes. So the point of that means to not resist the fact that this is difficult, because it is co-arising that when things end, good or bad, we are always going to be confused as to whether or not it was the right thing or not. What should I do? That confusion is always going to come together with things ending or changing or rearranging. But where liberation lies in the willingness to be with the difficulty just as it is and let it kind of unfold in its own way. I know it may not seem like, it may seem like if you could find the answer that says, should I do this or not? It seems like that would be the thing that would be the most easeful. But it's unknown. You don't know which is the right way. You don't know. That's the whole problem. The only thing you do know for sure is that it's difficult. And if it's difficult, that's where liberation lies, in finding a way to not resist the fact that it's difficult. Does that make sense? I mean, I know it's not what we want to hear, but it's the only thing. It's sort of like you are not experiencing anything that's not the nature of being human. We all go through this in change. We never know if the decision we made, I quit my job, was that the right decision? Was that not the right decision? If I had that job, I'd be having a paycheck right now. But I hated that job, and it never worked out right. But maybe I should have kept that job, because maybe I needed the money. Maybe I shouldn't have left before I had another job. All of that is the nature of being human, to wander around trying to figure out the right thing to do. I think the Dhamma points us towards, yeah, there are things that we have to decide and we have to make decisions and who knows what they are. What really the practice is designed is to help us be good. Be still, be good with whatever we decide. I'm not going to resist the fact that this is so uncomfortable. I'm just going to have to work with a little bit of discomfort until I feel in the heart a resonance that says this is okay now. You see? So no rushing it, no trying to get a solution quick. If it passes you by, that's good. You'll be working with passing it by. It's okay. If it doesn't pass you by, okay, that's good too. Either way, your greater liberation is going to lie with working with the resistance and the urge to want to fix it. That's where your liberation is going to come. Yeah.
So my understanding of the talk tonight
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about reactivity, which made me think more about the hindrances.
It is. It's not so much as, so the question is that it seems like this talk giving everything that the ignorance is a sixth hindrance. And ignorance, it's like you said, it's the veil. It's not a sixth hindrance. It's what prevents us from knowing we're in a hindrance and instead we're trying to fix it. So we don't know we're in reactivity. We just think we're trying to fix the world to make it right. But that not knowing we're in reactivity is actually the ignorance that we live in. So we move through the world in this ignorance, thinking we're just fixing life and making life better, and instead we're caught in some reactivity. We're caught in some self versus non-self. A better way to think about it is ignorance is when we do not know what is the skillful means in this moment on how to be. What is the skillful means in this moment? Meaning the skillful means, meaning what can I do that's the least amount of harm and is not, it offers the greatest amount of goodwill. That means we have to learn when we're in a hindrance and when we're not. When we're in selfing and when we're not. When we're in trying to get our way and when we're not. That's what we're trying to do when we're in the seven factors and when we're not. That kind of understanding when we are, when we not, when wanting's present, when it's not, when not wanting's present, when it's not. That knowing this duality, we know it. When we know it, then we can know what skillful means in that moment. But mostly we live in this world of reactivity and selfing and getting our way and wanting and what's going to work out best for me and how do I get mine and all of that energy, not knowing that in that energy we never use skillful means. We are all, it's all based in greed, hatred, and delusion, and we don't use skillful means. So what we want to do is somehow or another be outside of that, be aware of it, and then begin to discern what is skillful and what is not. What would cause the least amount of harm? What would be the kindest thing? And sometimes the kindest thing, least amount of harm would be for me. So that's why it's not necessarily a sixth hindrance. It's the aspect of awareness to know that the hindrances are at play. Do you see that? That's the difference in it. It's actually if you feel any kind of, I don't know if I can go this far, but I'm going to go there anyway because this is what I would have told myself. If I feel any discomfort in anything, there's ignorance there. If I feel like things are going great, it's perfect, there's ignorance there. If I have an opinion, there's ignorance there. If I just move through life assuming this is the way it is, there's ignorance there. Do you see what I'm saying? There's a way in which when we check out and somehow we're going through life without paying attention to what's going on, there's ignorance there. And what we want to begin to do is see, it's a gradual practice, so the practice is going to work over years that we're going to begin to see more and more. But we just want to begin to upset the apple cart a bit and begin to notice how much we go through life on automatic pilot and not even paying attention to what we're doing. You got to ask yourself, is this real or is this Memorex? Is this the mind remembering this moment? Do I remember this cup of tea or am I actually drinking the cup of tea? What's happening here? That's what we want to begin to see. See? I got to stop. I got to stop. I love it. So next week, since it's the last week in the month, we're going to talk about both, a recap of this talk and then some actual ways we can practice with it and have a discussion about practicing. So look and see what you notice. How much ignorance do you notice? How much of your life is actually based in Memorex? And how much of it is real? And then we'll talk about it next week.